From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moskowain. There is a revolution going on, and it's being waged in school cafeterias across the nation. The campaign for more nutritious school lunches is gathering steam, and it doesn't hurt that First Lady Michelle Obama is on board in a big way. With her commitment to help fight childhood obesity, she is absolutely working to influence and make sure that our nation's schools serve healthier breakfasts and lunches, for that matter. And serving healthy school lunches involves much more than simply changing the menu. It takes money, which happens to be in short supply for many school food service programs. And then, of course, there's the challenge of retraining children's taste buds. For some, trading nachos for nectarines is just a tough sell. And this is what Free For All is all about. It's the title of a new book about fixing school food in America. It is written by Jan Poppendick, and she is a professor of sociology at Hunter College, City University of New York. We've also got with us today Virginia Stallings, who is professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Nutrition Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Virginia, welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Well, let's talk about these school lunches. You have been on committees that have come up with recommendations for school lunch and breakfast programs. Let's start with what's wrong with school lunches to begin with. Nutritionally, what kinds of problems are you seeing?
Well, you know, the school lunch program started initially in right after World War II, and the idea then was there really was hunger in America. And there was a lot of focus on being sure that there was enough food. As we've gone over the next 40 or 50 or 60 years, the nutritional needs for children have really shifted. And now we find, as you said, in the complex time where childhood obesity has become very common, as well as still hunger, that there's still children from lower-income families that may not have enough food going across the days and weeks. So the school lunch program, I think, hasn't been significantly revised since about 1995. And the public health issues that we now see hadn't really been managed as well. So, for example, the school lunch program for many years has had a lower calorie limit, but not an upper calorie limit, so that the people responsible made sure they did a great job of being sure there were enough calories, but there might have been too many. We've certainly learned how important more vegetables and fruit are to all of us, and particularly to children. School lunches were not known for their ability to serve and have consumed the fruits and vegetables. Yeah. Lastly, I'll just mention the issue of dairy food. School lunch has always been one of those places where children get their milk. And nationally, we didn't have across-the-board recommendations or standards about the fat content of the milk. So that's another area that was really ready to be reviewed and possibly make changes.
I have read, and tell me this if this is correct, if it sounds right, that the typical high school lunch has more than two times the recommended sodium limit, too many calories and fat, as you just mentioned, and too few fruits and vegetables.
I think that would be true. When we looked at the data we had from school surveys of, you know, really representative, we found those kinds of patterns. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting. There's also been a recent report you may be familiar with recognizing that we all eat too much sodium, yeah, too much salt. So what we can say with that is the menus in schools reflected that common overuse, and that the fat content had crept up, not only the total fat, but we're particularly interested in the saturated fat, which is the component that scientifically looks more related to heart disease and stroke and that sort of thing. Mm. So I think the current regulations did give some good standards, but like I said, had not been refined to really meet what we know from the medical and nutrition science and the public health needs of children in America today.
Jan Poppendick, welcome to the program. You have written a book called Free For All, Fixing School Food in America. You're very concerned about this topic, and one of the points that you make in the book is about the nutritional divide, so to speak, between higher income and lower income kids. And I'm interested to know, from your observation, how has that played itself out in terms of school lunches and who gets what?
Well, it's somewhat paradoxical in a sense, because in schools, I should should back up to say that there are close to 100,000 schools participating in the National School Lunch Program, and it's very difficult to generalize about what goes on in all those different schools. They have different leadership, they have different populations, but setting aside the complexities for a moment, in situations where lower-income children participate in the official federally regulated reimbursable meal, they are getting a meal that meets basic nutrition standards, as Dr. Stallings has just said, whereas often affluent youngsters want to show off their affluence by buying a la carte items. And when they do that, or vending machine items, but the pattern that I saw that disturbed me most was one in which affluent youngsters would stay away from the main line because they didn't want to be thought to be possibly perceived as poor, and were buying, you know, a Cinnabon and a Gatorade, or a Cinnabon and a couple of packages of chips from an a la carte section. Yeah. So there were situations in which the nutritional divide that exists in the broader community was in fact being reversed in the school.
Interesting. You actually put on an apron and went behind the scenes, so to speak, in a school cafeteria and really got a sense of how it works, what's served. Tell us a little bit about that and what it was that initially prompted you to go into the cafeterias and see for yourself what was going on.
Well, I went to try out the lunch lady role with an idea that it would help me ask better questions. I knew that I wanted to be interviewing school food service professionals, school food service directors, and cafeteria staff, and I thought I better see what it's like so that I could ask good questions. And I have to tell you, it was perhaps the most intensive week of education I've had in my life. And I highly recommend to parents out there who want to get involved in improving the food in their schools that they start by spending some time in the cafeteria, having lunch with their youngsters where that's permitted, meeting with the cafeteria staff, because it really is its own world with its own demands and requirements, and there are regulations that make enormous sense on paper at the federal level, which I think backfire as they play out in the realities of day-to-day. So I recommend spending some time in the school cafeteria.
Well, Jen, when you talk about it being a very intensive week of education for you, what were some of the highlights of your observations during that time?
Well, I think the thing that impressed me the most was how hard the staff were working. I was exhausted when I got home from my first few days. I went right to bed at 3 in the afternoon and took a long nap. There really was barely a minute of downtime. I mean, they took prescribed breaks, but other than that, they were busy every moment and needed to be in order to make the system work. If there was a slowdown on the line, they needed to be refilling the ketchup dispenser or, all of the things that go into keeping a meal service flowing. So that was one thing that made a big impression on me. The second thing that made an impression on me was a way in which I think the nutrition standards were backfiring. I'm going to give an example, and I know it's controversial among my anti-hunger advocate colleagues who have been asking for even higher standards in breakfast, but I saw something that troubled me. The school that I visited had breakfast in the classroom. Universal free breakfast in the classroom, something that many of us have been urging for a long while. But because the standard for the breakfast in the classroom required either two servings of grains or a serving of grain and a serving of meat in addition to the milk and the fruit or juice, the breakfast that many of us find to be the simplest healthy breakfast in America, cereal, fruit, and juice, would not meet the standard, and the school in which I was visiting dealt with that by adding a square of cheese. Okay, a terrific plan, makes a healthy meal, but because their labor hours were so limited, they only were willing to do that once a week because someone had to count out all the squares of cheese to go to the individual classrooms, and that was time-consuming enough that they weren't willing to do that on a frequent basis and instead relied heavily on pastry-type breakfast foods that were formulated to meet the requirement for the two grains, but that are probably not what we want to be teaching our children to eat at lunchtime. Mm-hmm. So I found a number of situations where very well-intended regulations were having counterproductive effects at the local level.
Virginia Stallings, I want to talk about the research that shows that American children are at the same time overfed and undernourished. I read a statistic that said among Caucasian children that one out of three born in the year 2000 will develop diabetes, and for Black and Hispanic children, two out of three. So that you've got children who, in some cases, have an abundance of food, but the wrong foods, and to Jan's point, sometimes food that is tailored to meet a requirement but isn't necessarily the most nutritious option. Talk about that and what the status is for our children in terms of their nourishment.
Well, as you said, I think we're in an unprecedented place for children and for child health as it relates to nutrition and growth, and really even body composition, because that goes to the issue with diabetes and many of the chronic disease. It's about getting overly fat, just like we know has been a problem in adults, but it's been a problem when you were 40 or 50 or 60. We're now seeing that in preteens and certainly in teenagers. And we do take that back to really two different things. One, it's in the nutrition world. It's about the total calories, the fat, and the amount of carbohydrate, the amount of sugar. And then in the physical activity side, the issue is you can eat more calories if you're more physically active. When you balance these two in children today, I think we have to recognize we need, with full appreciation of the physical activity component, it's the food component that's even more out of control. And so the food supply, and again, it goes directly, as Jan was saying, to how can we work with industry and food service groups to have better recipes, better foods in the schools. We have to find a way to have more nutrient dense, more of the good things in the serving of food, so that the calories and the sodium and the total fat can remain relatively low in a healthy range. But we're sure that they get all the vitamins and minerals, and that they get the satiety that they need to be able to enjoy and focus and learn.
And, of course, all of that takes money, and that is one of the key issues that school food administrators across the country are facing, that by the time they pay the overhead and pay for supplies and all of that, there's very little to put toward nutritious lunches. We're going to talk about that and more, and we'd love to hear from you as well. Give us a call at 888-477-9499. We're talking about school lunches when Radio Times comes right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to making lives better every day. They've developed a partnership with the University of Pennsylvania for Cancer Treatment, Radiology, and Radiation Oncology. Details at chestercountyhospital.org.
Dance Celebration supports WHYY and presents Moses Pendleton's troupe of dancer illusionists, Momix, in performances of Pendleton's newest full-length creation, Botanica. Inspired by the wonders and magic of nature, Botanica features large-scale puppets, projected imagery, and larger-than-life props. May 20th through 23rd at the Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets at 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It's easy and inexpensive for almost anyone to be a journalist these days, but how trustworthy is all the news and commentary you encounter? WHYY still practices journalism the old-fashioned way. We check the facts and make sure the stories you hear are fair, balanced, and trustworthy. We need your financial support to keep WHYY on the radio. Please call 1-888-345-9499 or give online at whyy.org.
Support for WHYY is provided by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association. Educating all children for a bright future. PSEA, the power of a great education.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, sitting in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about mystery meat, otherwise known as school lunches. We're talking about the movement that really is gathering steam among many groups who are wanting to make sure that our children are eating more nutritious lunches and breakfasts, for that matter, at school, and that they're able to do it at low or no cost. We have been talking with Virginia Stallings, who is a professor of pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and she was the chair of the Institute of Medicine report on school lunches in 2009 called School Meals, Building Block for Healthy Children. We also have with us Jan Poppendick, who is a sociologist at Hunter College, part of the City University of New York. Jan is the author of Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. We've been talking about how Jan went behind the scenes, put on an apron, and became a lunch lady, and just got an alarming and wonderful education there, finding out about what our children are eating and what's going on in school cafeterias. Jan, we were talking a little bit, or started to talk about the money issue, because that's a critical issue that you raise in the book, that there just, by the time the bills are paid, isn't a whole lot of money to devote to purchasing healthy food for cafeterias. What's happening there?
Well, it's not just that there's not enough money to purchase the food, but also the labor hours that go into preparation. You know, it's a trade-off. If you have the equipment to prepare food on site and you can afford more labor, you may actually be able to get better meals out of a modest expenditure on food. So it's a complex set of calculations that school districts have to make. But overall, I think our investment is too low. I think we are investing too little in to provide the optimal healthy meals that our youngsters need. And I'm pretty sure that the IOM recommendations also have came to this a similar conclusion.
In Virginia, the government has added some money to school lunches, has provided some additional dollars. Many people say not enough, but at least it's a start. What's happening with that? Because it sounds like school districts really are forced to work with not very much.
Right. Well, the money issue, I think, is complex, and want to mention just in passing, one of the things that many schools find themselves facing now is some of the money from school meals, and particularly money from vending and the a la carte sales, had been used for other things in the school. And so one of the most difficult policy decisions schools are going to have to make is, if you decrease vending, for example, as has been really recommended, and as you increase the quality of the meals, they are going to have to really look at the budget in a different way. So there's the within-school budget. The other issue is, of course, as we're going through this process, and right now Congress is reconsidering the reauthorization bill that directly makes the laws and does the financial allocation for school meals. And so, yes, we are very much, many of us in the advocacy world from all aspects, are hoping to get another few pennies, few quarters for the school meals, because that will help. In the new recommendations, we very much needed to be cost aware, cost conscious. And as we made the recommendations to really improve the nutritional quality of the breakfast, to get fruits in every breakfast, there is going to be an increase in our estimate. And again, we weren't formulated in the way the accounting offices are, but maybe an 18% increase in the cost of breakfast, in the food cost of breakfast. And so we've passed that information on to the government as they think about the allocations for the next 5 years. I'm aware that the Obama administration also has a different pot of money that they may consider using to help school meals that might be separate. In the breakfast, that directly goes, as I said, to adding more of our vegetables. In the lunch program, the cost increase is really much more modest. We estimate about 4%. And that's because we can use, as we change the items being served, we can use that money that might have been for more protein or meat for more vegetables. Mm-hmm. And in the school lunch program, we're very much pushing just a couple of major changes. One is changing the variety of vegetables at every meal, And it does go back to what our mothers always taught us about the orange ones and the green ones and all of that. But it's a pattern that can be implemented, we believe, in the cafeteria setting that would dramatically increase the variety of vegetables, which will increase the nutritional value. Also, in the program as it exists today, fruits and vegetables are in one category. So to be more effective in improving the quality, we wanted vegetables to count as vegetables and have this list of variety, and fruits to count as fruits. And some of those simple changes will really, if you will, force the system into different menus. But as we do improve the quality, as we reduce things that are less expensive, and often those are high fat, high salt, high sugar items, there will be a modest increase. The committee that I worked with, and certainly those of us now continuing to talk about this, see this as really a modest investment in child health. To be able to now tie the health of children to school meals, and if a child is taking both lunch and breakfast over a year, it represents about 50% of their eating opportunities. Yeah. There's no other way in any other program that we could have such an impact using this important community setting, both for education, maybe they'll learn more about healthy foods by the examples, but just simply providing better foods for children. Yeah.
So it's really a golden opportunity to influence the nutrition of children.
It's just spectacular. Like I said, the combination of the government and the USDA in particular, who manages all of these programs, the school breakfast and lunch program, and also the Women, Infant, and Children program, came to the IOM saying, we know we need to redo these. We need to upgrade our food basket, our food menu, to go with science, and have been very receptive to thinking about, it's not just we need healthy foods for children so they'll be healthy adults, which might have been what you would heard 10 or 20 years ago. We need healthy foods for children so they'll be healthy children. Mm-hmm. And all of that, like along with the obesity epidemic and the absolute impact that will have on America's health and health expenses, we haven't had an opportunity like this, I think, ever.
Well, and it's critical because if what I read is correct, there are some studies that show that this generation of children might be the first to not live as long as their parents.
That's true. There have been a couple of epidemiological studies where they predict the risk of these important life-limiting chronic diseases. And because of the profile of the children, teenagers, and young adults, we are at risk of people having more of the chronic diseases and be life-threatening, life-shortening.
Jen, I'm wondering if you are familiar with this report that said that the standards for meat in particular in school lunches in some cases does not meet the same level of standards for fast food restaurants, that in some school districts that children are being served what they say are old hens, the meat is just not as good, the quality is not as good, and that there are fast food restaurants that adhere to higher standards than those that are set for school lunches. What do you say about that, Jen?
Well, I saw the press coverage, not the reports themselves. So I, I'm not in a position to deconstruct it for you. But what I think is that when food service personnel face the kind of cost constraint that we've been talking about, where every penny, literally a price that adds a penny to the cost of a meal, can be a make-or-break situation, and where we have been demanding that they break even, that school districts not have to put local funds into subsidizing the school meal program, then I think it's a setup for choosing less wholesome, in some cases, forms of meat if they're cheaper. I think the argument that the USDA foods, what we used to call commodity foods, are of lower quality is typically not accurate. The USDA typically procures pretty high-end and certainly safe meats.
Let's go to the phones now to South Philadelphia. Jim is standing by. Jim, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I teach in a high school in South Jersey, and I've often thought it would be better to take an interdisciplinary approach to all this, which I don't see happening too often, and not only change the foods that children are eating in the cafeteria, but to teach them about what they're eating and correct eating habits in health class, and then tie that into their phys ed classes. I was just wondering if either of your guests had any comments about that, if schools are doing that, and I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call, Jim. Virginia?
Well, Jim, I think you're absolutely right, and it depends a bit right now. And as Jan said at the beginning, school districts are so different one from another. But there are some that are doing absolutely innovative and interdisciplinary work around nutrition education, around food from the farm to the table, to learn more about ecology, and to put all of that together. But the other side of that's true. That really depends on the school innovation and the teachers and that sort of thing. Currently, the curriculum doesn't have as much nutrition and health, well, as much nutrition education or food nutrition education as I agree would be helpful. One of the things, I come out of the medical side of things, so I know one of the most powerful ways of getting things into the curriculum is getting a few questions into the exams. And so one of the things that we've begun to try to talk about in the right places is now the performance tests for schools are so important that is another way that if we want to guide the curriculum in that direction, that may be one of the tasks. Also, as the USDA and the government make rules and regulations, they could make comments about the nutrition education. But traditionally, that's been more the purview either at the state level or the district level. So there are all sorts of opportunities there.
Yeah. Jan, what about the whole idea of re-educating children's taste buds as part of this process? Certainly, we hear on the one hand the reports of students in Chicago who say, you know, enough with the burritos, enough with the frozen pizza, enough with the chicken nuggets and the mystery meat. We want healthy food. But there are a whole lot of children who love their chicken nuggets and their French fries and their pizza and those kinds of things. And what would you say to parents, to school districts about the whole idea of just re-educating children's taste buds and making healthy food appealing to them?
Well, I think it's an essential challenge. I mean, I think we have to find a way to move that direction, because don't forget that our children are subject to $10 to $12 billion a year in advertising for some of the nation's least healthy foods. So, you know, the deck is stacked, and unless schools can help children develop an appreciation for take whole grains, for instance, for years, our culture assumed that little children would only eat fluffy white bread. As schools have become more conscious of the nutrition issues, and some have begun to experiment with introducing whole grain breads into their cafeterias, there's resistance at first, and eventually the kids come around. I suspect that there are adults in your listening audience who've gone through the same tradition, I mean, the same transition. So, you know, I think we all need to remember that our food habits do change, and we do make changes in the way we eat, but schools need to be helping children formulate healthy habits, because they're being pushed in the opposite direction by so much of the advertising in our culture.
Hmm. Virginia?
I think one of the examples of that also is the issue around sodium. And there really is very good information about each of us can have a reduction in our sensitivity to salt. And so one of the opportunities, both for the whole nation and certainly for the school foods over the next decade, is to gradually reduce the sodium exposure in the ready-made foods, the recipes. And I think this is, we haven't talked much, but I think that the partnership with the food industry that serves the school lunch and breakfast program is ready to try to help, to be innovative, to come up with new foods, to address some of these issues about how do we get really high-quality vegetables on the school trays that kids will eat, and particularly around issues of whole grain rich products. They don't all have to be fully whole grain, but it looks like most of us, as Jan was saying, can get up to 50 to 70% whole grain in almost any product and still have the same taste perception and still like it about as much. And then some things really can be whole grain. But even the concept of whole grain rich has, I think, a good place in schools. And we've all had this discussion about reducing the fat content in milk and the sugar content in milk if it's flavored milk. Again, an opportunity that we believe industry is going to help step up and find a way to have flavored milks that will have much less added sugar but still taste good and have the mouthfeel. Mm. So these are the kinds of things that the committee was hoping these recommendations might become nationwide. Then you have industry looking at it as a very different, well-organized market, and they're more likely to step up if you can sell the same food in New Jersey and Delaware and Pennsylvania and New York, thinking about our region.
Well, let's go to Cherry Hill, and we'll bring Alana into the conversation. I hope I'm saying your name right. Welcome to Radio Times. Alana, are you there?
Yes.
Are we saying your name right? I'm sorry.
That's Ilana, and
Ilana.
I have a question about how come in the same school district kids are served different meal depending if they are in an elementary school or in a high school, and by different, I mean different quality. My elementary school kid served fairly healthy choices. The high schooler cannot eat in her cafeteria. Everything is fried.
So you're saying same district, but depending on the age level, that the quality of food is different from your experience.
Yeah, and I don't understand because it seems to be the same food company that serves it.
Well, thank you for your question, and I'm going to go to Jan for that. Did you notice anything like that, Jan, in your travels and your spending time in cafeterias about different quality of food within the same school district, or what might be an explanation for that?
Yeah, absolutely, and again, a lot of it comes back to the local economics of school food. School food operators are in a situation where they're trying to break even, not only across the district, but in any particular school. And overall, participation rates are much higher in elementary schools. And when you get to the middle school, and especially the high school level, many school food operators feel that the best way to get youngsters to participate in the program so that the federal reimbursements will come in and the students' payments will come in, is to serve the foods that we think of as teen foods or kid foods, the nuggets and the pizza and the fried everything, so that there is a shift toward more and more carnival foods, as one observer has characterized them, when you reach the high school level. And it's partly because in many districts, high school students have the option of leaving at lunchtime.
I'm going to stop you right there, Jan, because we need to take a quick break, but I want to pick up that thought when we come back. We also want to talk about First Lady Michelle Obama and her commitment to this cause and the influence that she brings as well. 888-477-9499 is the number to call Radio Times.
Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers a master's degree in public health, plus online master's in healthcare quality and safety, health policy, and chronic care management. An open house will be held Wednesday, May 12th at 6 p.m. in the College Building, 1025 Walnut Street. Registration by phone 215-503-5305 or online at jefferson.edu. The Jefferson School of Population Health, helping to make a difference in healthcare.
I'm Marty Moscowain. At WHYY, we value our editorial independence, and we believe you do too. A rigorous editorial process ensures that the stories you hear are fair, balanced, and accurately reported. That might seem old-fashioned, but it's still the best way to ensure that you can trust what you hear. Help WHYY remain your trusted source for news and information. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online now at whyy.org.
JerseyArts.com supports WHYY, featuring details on Grounds for Sculpture, located just outside Princeton, New Jersey, and showcasing hundreds of outdoor contemporary sculptures on 35 landscaped acres, dining, concerts, classes, and more. Current indoor gallery exhibitions include works by Keith Haring and Chikaya Booker. Directions and calendar of events at groundsforsculpture.org. Grounds for Sculpture and more online at jerseyarts.com.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, sitting in for Marty Moskowain, and we are talking about school lunches and some of the problems associated, the nutritional problems associated with them for children, both lunches and breakfasts, for that matter. We're talking with Virginia Stallings, who's a professor of pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and she was also the chair of the Institute of Medicine report on school lunches in 2009 called School Meals, Building Block for Healthy Children. We also have with us Jan Poppendick, who is a sociologist at Hunter College. That's part of the City University of New York, and her book is called Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. Jan, when we left off, we were talking about why there is a different, not only type of food, but quantity of, or quality of food sometimes between elementary school and high school, even within the same district. And you said that oftentimes that is a deliberate choice that is made for financial reasons and other reasons to draw in and to serve those kinds of, I won't say kid-friendly, but kid-attractive type foods, pizza, chicken nuggets, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that as students grow older, they have more options. As I was mentioning, that many districts permit their high school students to leave school at the lunch hour. In fact, many districts count on youngsters leaving school at the lunch hour because their cafeterias are not adequate in size to hold everyone, and they don't want to devote the time to multiple lunch hours. So I found all over the country kids leaving sometimes to go to fast food restaurants, but my least favorite, to the gas station convenience store.
Oh, my.
Pick up their lunch.
Interesting, because you also mentioned earlier in the program that the way that that then plays itself out is that you have these children who may have greater means in some cases to either leave campus or to make other choices beyond just sort of what the standard options are, and oftentimes those are less nutritional choices as well.
Right. Well, if you've been in a gas station convenience store lately, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes, indeed.
But that does then put the food service in the position of trying to compete, and they have often chosen to compete by kind of mimicking what's out there. Now, this is not universally the case, and I'm thinking back to Jim's question about integrating what's in the cafeteria with what we teach students about food, and I want to say that there are food services in here and there around the country that are doing a fantastic job of increasing the quality and integrating it with the classroom. It's not something that the cafeteria can do on its own. It has to have leadership from the education part of the school, from the principal and the teachers.
And Jan, from your observation, what school districts or what areas of the country do you think are doing this particularly well? Because you've noted in your book that there are some districts that are managing to serve healthy food at low or no cost, so that it can be done.
Right. Well, when you say low or no cost, you mean that they're not jacking up the price that's paid to students. In Vermont, I was very impressed with the activities of a group called FEED, Food Education Every Day, and their involvement with the school food service in Burlington, Vermont, which has really set terrific examples for many other schools and districts to follow. So I'd urge your listeners to take a look at what's going on in Burlington. I'd urge them to take a look at what's going on in Portland, Oregon, in New York City, which is the largest food service operation in the nation, where we serve some 850,000 meals a day. We face a particularly big challenge to get the good food out, but we have a program called Cookshops, which teaches youngsters about food, where it comes from, how to cook it in the classroom, and whenever possible, that lesson is reflected in the menu for the day. So there are a lot of innovations out there, and folks should take a look. I, of course, think the easiest way to do that would be to read the next to last chapter of my book.
Which is called Free for All, by the way, Fixing School Food in America. Virginia Stallings, let's talk about First Lady Michelle Obama, because this is a big issue for her, childhood obesity, and part of that, of course, is serving healthy lunches in schools. How big an influence is the First Lady? How much can she help your cause?
Well, I think we all absolutely welcome the national attention that something like Michelle Obama putting this out front. And she is taking the approach from the childhood obesity concern, but she and the whole group working with her are much more comprehensive than that. So I think, yes, we are trying to prevent childhood obesity. But the real focus, and I think she's done an outstanding job with bringing attention to this, is looking at all the important places for children and food. So she is engaging parents in schools and industry, also the physical activity part. Because of their position, they can look at what's going on in safe playground areas. They can look to the Department of Education to address some of the things, as Jan was saying. We've built many schools in the last 15 or 20 years that don't have adequate cafeteria space and also don't have adequate physical activity space. Yeah. So how are we going to turn that around? Particularly for the school meals, again, we're at this unique place where all of this interest and hopefully good reports and scientific evidence is coming at a time where Congress is about to pass the new legislation that will be what guides both of these programs through the next 5 years.
And when you say new legislation, you're talking about the Child Nutrition Act,
right,
correct?
The Reauthorization Act. And every 5 years, Congress takes a look at basically the highest level rules, and that's why the recommendations about changing the menus, changing the way we monitor things. If those laws are passed, and at this point we're very encouraged that that will be happening, then that directs the USDA, which is the group in the government that manages these programs, to come out with all sorts of new regulations. And Jan was mentioning some of the regulations don't result in the outcome that we want. Yeah. The USDA, all the way to the secretary and undersecretary that run these programs, have been very receptive to the reports, have really engaged in a dialogue with the committee and with the other stakeholders. Mm. So I think there's no question tying this to childhood obesity will help us get urgently needed changes made now. Yeah. I always do like to emphasize, though, that this is so fundamental to the whole child health. So it's not just to help the children who are obese or that might be becoming obese. These kinds of changes, and as it results in better food and more children participating in the meals, will help every single child because that feeding opportunity will now be to their benefit, not neutral and not bad.
Yeah. Let's go to Bella Kenwood, and we'll welcome Andrea to our conversation. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. They asked me to keep this brief, and I'll try my best. You had a gentleman who I believe he said taught in the New Jersey school system, and he mentioned an interdisciplinary approach. He really piqued my interest because my daughter is a school lunch lady. You had another caller that said how hard they work, and she does work very hard. But one of the observations that she's made is that the waste is incredible, that the children take many things on their trays and end up trashing half of it in many cases. And I thought that that exemplifies that they don't really know what to choose, what constitutes for them a healthy lunch. So I thought that in attempting an interdisciplinary approach, you must not leave out the lunch ladies because they are the people who observe what the children really do at lunchtime.
Well, that's a great point, Andrea. And Jan Popendick, I'd like you to address it. Having been a lunch lady for a while in the process of writing your book, what do you say about that?
Well, I want to start with the waste issue because waste of food is something that troubles me whenever I encounter it. And, you know, it's fashionable to say that our mothers made us neurotic by telling us that children were starving in other parts of the world, but I don't really buy that. I think all cultures need to have a respect for food and for the labor that goes into producing it, and preparing it and serving it. And so I really hate to see food waste. And with younger children, personally, I would prefer to see us move in the direction of family-style lunch service with adults interacting with children in the cafeteria. I think if you've got kids lining up and choosing a tray in a great hurry, and there's, you know, lunch hours are absurdly short in our schools, you're always going to have a lot of food going to waste. And, you know, in our culture now, with a lot of concern about liability and a lot of concern about foodborne illnesses, anything that a child has taken cannot be returned to the supply. So it is going to go into the waste. So I would really like to see us using school meals as an opportunity to teach children to take what you're going to eat and eat what you take, which I think is a sane and healthy approach for a culture. Obviously, this would require putting a much bigger priority on the school meal than most schools have currently been willing or felt they were able to do. It does get back to the interdisciplinary notion in Jim's question, because then we would be using the lunch hour or the breakfast hour as a time to really teach our children important values, not just about food, but also about social responsibility to other people and to the environment. And I believe that the lunchroom staff could play a very crucial role in that. I also want to kind of back up what Andrea is saying about listening to lunch ladies. They have been telling us for generations that the current system with free meals, reduced price meals, and full price meals doesn't work very well at the ground level, that it turns some children off from the food, that it's an enormous administrative burden, that it's very inefficient, and now we have piles of studies that show how error-prone it is. Mm-hmm. Lunch ladies have been telling us that there's a lot of waste of human time and effort in the system the way we're operating it now, and that's why you can probably tell from the title that my book really argues that we need to move to the pattern of serving all children a meal as a regular part of the school day.
Indeed, and the book is called Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. In our last minute, Virginia Stallings, for those parents who pack lunches, or maybe they've been listening to our program and are thinking about packing lunches, what should a healthy packed brown bag lunch include?
Excellent question. So, out of all of the work we've done, of course, we haven't any data really on what those packed lunches are, nor do we know how much swapping is, other than in the Sunday cartoons, how much swapping is going on. But I think if you look at the general recommendations, what we would be looking for is something that would have some vegetables in it, some whole grain, and a meat or something, some sort of protein source. And fruit and vegetables, if you have a choice and they're only going to eat one at the lunchtime, I would encourage vegetables rather mm-hmm. than fruit if you have that choice. And the part about what the protein source is can be many different things. It can be cheeses and peanut butter. It can be the traditional meats. And lastly, the importance, I think, in the school setting of getting in that one serving of dairy, no-fat dairy or skim. And we are very much recommending to decrease the juice. So we'd like water or milk.
Well, there you have it. We're talking about school lunches. Thank you so much, Virginia Stallings, Jan Poppendick, for being our guests today. And I'm Tracy Matisak, and this is Radio Times.
And I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Susan Greenbaum, and we are in the absolute final day of the membership drive here at WHYY. We will either make our goal or we will not, and we began the day about $50,000 short. We will make that goal with your pledge of support at 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. And I'm with Susan Greenbaum, one of the producers of Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
You might be wondering, why is Marty Marty Moss Cohen here. Well, the fact is we pulled her back from her vacation. Just she postponed it a day.
It's, yes.
This day it was a staycation, right?
Something like that. It was a staycation.
Anyway,
yes,
she exactly. Volunteered to come in and help us make the case for why you should support WHYY and public broadcasting.
Absolutely. And we do this, as you know, a couple of times a year. And it is a reminder that you play such an important role here at WHYY. If you listen to the program, you are listening to the program, that you know that a program like Radio Times, which produces 500 live hours of of interviews, and that's because Susan and the other producers put it all together. We do that every year. It's a long form interview. We can get into topics with a great deal of depth. We have a wonderful substitute host, Tracy Matisak, and we put it together for you because we want to make sure that you are informed about the world that we all live in. And again, we want you to make that call at 1-888-345-9499. Yes, I cut into my vacation to be here because it's that important that we stay on track. We're going to end it today, but the question is, will we make the goal?
As listeners of Radio Times and WHYY, we have a hunch that you understand how challenging this work is, but more importantly, how much it adds to your life. If you're someone like me, I go through my day with NPR, WHYY,
absolutely.
And I can sort of tell what time it is by what show is on. We need your support in order to make this kind of programming available. You know, Marty, you know as well as I do that we spend about $1.5 million for our national programming.
And that's just the national
just program. The national programming. It's your dollars that make it possible. So please give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. And don't forget, you can pledge online at whyy.org.
In fact, we heard this morning that Elaine Kagan is President yep. Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court. And this morning on Radio Times, I think before 9 o'clock, Susan had already put together a program tomorrow on Radio Times to take a look at that nomination. That's what we do on a program like Radio Times. That's why you listen to this program, to understand this complex world, to put decisions into some kind of context and make sure that you understand the world we live in. We don't tell you what to think, what mm-mm. to believe in, what your opinions are. We present the information to you. You're a smart person, and then you put it together to make it work for you. Again, that phone number is 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. We have students from the Barbara Seninato School of Ballet. They have joined us here at the WHYY studios, and we do want to put them to work. And, of course, you can always pledge online at whyy.org.
You know, Marty, I was thinking before about the range